Hello and welcome to this week's episode of YesCast. My name is Toni.
And my name is Ella.
And today we'll talk about recovery with our guest Tina Hoffman from First Beat Technologies. In this episode, we're going to discuss how to balance and monitor stress and recovery, how to improve wellness in workplace, and what are some of the recent findings related to recovery. We'll also get to learn how to structure a daily life that supports recovery. Good to have you here. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation.
We are here with Tina. She's an exercise physiologist and master trainer and works at First Beat as a wellness specialist. And to maintain a good balance in her own life, she enjoys the outdoors, does kayaking, hiking, and cross-country skiing. Hi, and welcome, Tina. And nice to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. It's really nice to be here. And I must say that this morning, with all the new snow that we had on the ground, it didn't seem like a fun thing. It was more like a stress factor because we had maybe 10 inches of new snow and I was late because I couldn't get out of my driveway. So that was my stress peak this morning.
Okay, yeah, I can imagine the feeling. Do you want to introduce yourself shortly to start with and tell how you got into the position you are in today?
Yeah, I think you did a good job giving my background, but maybe why I'm here at First Beat today. So my own background is in sports. I was a competitive athlete when I was younger, and then I worked many years as a ski coach. I actually went to study at the University of Alaska in Anchorage long, long time ago. And after I got my bachelor's degree there, and I ended up coaching skiing at the university for 5 years. And since then, I've done lots of different things. I've worked in academia for many years and done some applied studies in overtraining and things like that. And then gradually, I switched from the world of sports into the performance of regular people. So today, I work with normal people, with their health and well-being. And that's what we do at First Beat. We have sports side that focuses on elite athletes, but then our wellness business focuses on helping normal working age people perform better and stay healthier. And that's where my job is today. But I draw many of the principles from sports in regular life, that just in the same way as an athlete must have balance between their training and their recovery, so also us normal people must have the same.
Sounds interesting. I think we will have a very interesting conversation today. And to warm up and get into the topic of today, we'll start with a warm-up question. So, Tina, what's a common misconception related to recovery?
Well, one I would say is that recovery is the same as sleep, or sleep means recovery. And of course, we all need sleep. In any case, sleep is good for us, but it just because you sleep doesn't necessarily mean that you're recovering. So for example, a person who has huge amounts of stress in their lives and is maybe overloaded with stress, they might be exhausted in the evening, they might sleep 8 hours, but the quality of their sleep might be quite poor if that stress is really working on their body and on their mind while they are sleeping. So that it's not guaranteed that you get good recovery just because you are sleeping. And maybe related to that is it's part of the same thing, but it's easy to think that alcohol helps me recover. I think many, many young people and people of all ages think that, oh, I'll have a few drinks, it'll help me recover. But physiologically, it's not like that at all, that alcohol is a stress factor. And unfortunately, it fairly effectively blocks recovery during sleep. So it's not a good way to boost recovery, even if it sometimes might mentally feel quite nice.
What are the effects of alcohol? What does it do for recovery? Why does it like harm the recovery process?
Yeah, it keeps your heart rate elevated, and it keeps your, we'll probably talk a little bit about the autonomic nervous system, but alcohol sort of blocks the recovery part of the nervous system from kicking in or becoming activated. So it keeps the body in kind of a stress mode. And the more you drink, the longer that takes sort of to burn off the effects of that alcohol. So you might fall asleep hard and think that you slept like a log, but the quality is usually quite poor. And I think many people have seen it if they were a Garmin or an Oura Ring or something like that.
Yeah, at least two people around this table are wearing Garmin wearables at this moment. So yeah, I have definitely seen that same phenomenon that after a late night party, the heart rate is usually quite high. So yeah, I can definitely attest to that. You have a lot of blog posts on the First Beat side, and I would like to dive into like some of the themes at this point. So you have blog posts related to like how physical activity and sleep and work environment affects recovery. I think one of the very interesting topics that you had in one of your blogs was this burnout versus bore out. What could you say, like phenomenon? So could you open this up a little bit? What does this burnout versus bore out mean?
Yeah, so sort of on the background of that, we need to understand what stress is. So when I talk about stress, it's a very normal part of life. It's the gas that keeps us going in a way and helps us perform. So stress in itself is very normal and it belongs to life. But if it's chronic and excessive, so if we have too much stress all the time, then it starts to cause health problems. For example, burnout. So burnout is usually caused by long-term excessive imbalance between stress and recovery, or simply just having too many demands and too much stress. So that's sort of the burnout end of that, means that you have too much and your body finally can't handle it. And then you start kind of breaking down with that. But then I think, and the problem with that further is that it's very individual. There is no magic formula that you can have this much stress and then everything will be okay. But if it goes over that, then you start having problems. But it's different for each of us. Some people can handle very heavy amounts of stress. They can have lots of stuff going on all day. As long as they get their sleep, they'll be just fine. Whereas other people, the balance can be much more fine or fickle. So it means that they really have to pay attention to that and be careful not to overdo that. So each of us needs to kind of find that optimal point of stress. And then the term bore out, it's kind of in the other end of that spectrum. It wasn't invented, but it came out during the pandemic when we were all stuck inside our houses and there was no hobbies and we didn't go to work. We worked from our home offices all the time and almost everything sort of fun and active was taken away from our lives. So some people, even if it was mentally very stressful, they started feeling signs of bore out, meaning that they were kind of, it was so monotonous and in a way boring and there was lack of activation or lack of activity in their lives. And if this happens for a long time, if a person just doesn't have enough stimuli and enough things going on in their lives, they can start having similar physiological symptoms as burnout, even if the cause is basically very much opposite. I think in the big picture, it's clearly not nearly as big of a problem as burnout. For most people, that seems like a ridiculous problem, that not having enough stuff going on because most people are overburdened. But it's good to be aware of that if you feel like you're in a rut and there's nothing going on that really stimulates and activates you, it might be time to try to do something different or try to find some kind of a new engaging activity that you can sort of pour yourself into, because we do need that also to stay engaged and be able to really perform at that top level.
I do at least recognize the how hard it is to find the optimal balance. I've been like on the verge of burnout twice, and that has left me very oversensitive to stress. And that leads to either I'm taking on way too much or way too little, and then it causes very big problems. Do you have any tips on how to find like the optimal way of working and how to know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And it's not an easy, like I said before, there's no magic formula for that, just because we are so different. And I think we'll probably talk a little bit about measuring, but I do think that despite all the great measurement devices that there are nowadays, it's about self-knowledge too, that starting to identify those kind of warning signs before you're in the pit and kind of you know, it's really takes a long time to climb yourself back out of that, to start noticing that you're having sleep problems or that you can't concentrate or you just kind of feel the stress kind of pounding in your head. And then I think everyone needs to have like a toolkit, like what are your personal ways of handling that situation when it's getting to be too much, learning to say no, having some kind of a relaxing activity that you can get your mind off work. It can be anything. It can be wandering in the forest, or it can be crossword puzzle, or it can be meditation, listening to great music. So it really, there is a huge range of stress busting methods in a way. But I always, in my talks, I try to encourage people to just really try and find what works for them, what helps get their brain and mind off from that stressful situation.
Yeah, I think for me, the learning to say no and drawing my limits is probably the biggest one I'm still struggling with.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really true that you can do only so much meditation or mindfulness or deep breaths if you constantly overpack your schedule. So then the other things doesn't help. So yeah, you have to start with that to make sure that your schedule is manageable. And sometimes it simply is that if you know that there is already enough, so sometimes the right thing is to do just that, say no and pass it on to some other time.
Yeah.
How do you know which, what are the ways in which you know what kind of like stress relieving mechanism is working for you? So I would like to dive deeper into first like the methods that everyone can, like how every person can monitor their recovery. So what are the ways? You talked a little bit about the sleeping habits and how they might change when you are too stressed. But what are like other signs that you are, let's say, too much on the burnout side of the spectrum?
Yeah, I guess this feeling that no matter how much you do, you still can't get it all done, that this feeling that there is more demanded of you than what you have resources to really deal with that. So that kind of overwhelming feeling, it's okay. Sometimes everyone has those kind of days occasionally, but if that's sort of every day the situation is like that, if you feel like I often use this rubber band example, that if you feel like you are like a rubber band that stretched to the limit every day, so you just barely make it to the end of the day. So that's not a good situation, because when something new comes up, a new challenge or a new obstacle, then it snaps, then there is no place to go. But if you have resilience, which means this ability to stretch and meet new demands, then when a new challenge comes, you can sort of dig into that reservoir that you have and are able to meet that. So maybe that's one of the good ways to start recognizing that it just mentally is this feeling that are you stretched to the limit all the time, or do you have something in reserve?
How do you improve this resilience then? When do you know you're not pushing yourself too far? Like, what is the limit? Because you, in order to improve the resilience, you have to push yourself in some way. But when do you know you're pushing yourself too much?
I think it all comes back to what you said earlier, that we have to learn to kind of recognize those signs before it's too late. And it's not easy by any means, but when something starts sort of breaking, you start getting sick all the time, or you are not sleeping anymore, you're getting really aggravated, or you're snapping at your friends or your spouse or something like that. So those are signs that maybe there is too much going on. And I do think that some kind of data, it can definitely help a lot, because it can be, we get so used to being stressed out and we get used to being tired that for many people that becomes kind of their norm state. It's assumed that you are tired and you need several cups of coffee to keep going. And so it's not always easy to rely on being able to recognize that feeling. And that's where some kind of data, there's many wearables that people have that they have lots of good features, as long as you don't sort of rely on them too much. If you start blindly looking at your monitor all the time and just assuming that that's the full truth, then that might not be the right way to go about that. But it can be helpful if you start seeing that your normal, like you mentioned, that you had noticed in your device that when you have a party that your sleep values are not nearly as good. So when you measure regularly, you have some kind of a baseline. That's what's kind of normal for you. And when you suddenly start seeing it, okay, now it looks really different. It looks like maybe if it measures stress, you start seeing much more stress reactions in the evening or during the night. Or maybe you have some kind of recovery activity that typically helps you relax and recover. And then if you notice that even if you are lying down and breathing deeply and doing your relaxation, but physiologically, if nothing happens, if you can't get your heart rate to slow down and you can't have that kind of a nervous system response, so then it's a sign of something that for some reason, even if you're mentally trying to relax, physically your body is not going there. And that's kind of like a warning sign that what could be causing that.
Is the right thing at that point just to take a break from everything? Because I recognize that in myself that I'm sometimes so...
like overwhelmed.
Yes, like overwhelmed that I feel like my body doesn't recover at all. I'm just lying in my bed and trying to sleep, but I feel like it doesn't calm down at all. So is it then just best to maybe take a few days off and like try to really get the body to calm down? Or what would you say is the best way to?
Well, I think the very first thing would be to try to understand what's the sort of the main cause of that. Is it just too much of everything, or is it certain, if it's a situation, like an acute situation that's causing that kind of stress, that they try to identify the cause of the overload. And then of course, sometimes it can, taking a couple of days, it can help, but clearly if you're not solving the problem that's behind it, then a couple of days, it might make you feel good for a few days, but then if you're right back to where it was before. So I think both work communities and individuals need to start identifying those causes and then addressing them in the best possible way, at least in some way, so that it doesn't get right back to the what it was before. And I think this has happened to many people who have had burnout and have had to maybe take a longer leave from work. If they come right back to what it was before they went on their burnout, very often it repeats. So it's important that those issues that were causing it are identified and really sort of in depth understood what was causing that.
Yeah, that is true. For me, at least, it happened again. But then again, it's also hard when you are really excited to do something new, like with our year now in UVascular Entrepreneurship Society. We have had a lot of new things that we have been doing. And when you are so excited that you want to try everything, it might sometimes be hard to maybe take it a step back because you want to try out a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, that comes to positive and negative stress, that there is negative stress that starts to have problems much more quickly. Like if you have too much stress that's causing you sort of negative feelings, so that clearly is a health problem. But also positive stress, which is just like you explained, when you have a new job or new interesting challenges, or you are in love, or you just bought a new house, something that makes you really happy, that in basically it's good for you, but if it's too much and it keeps going day after day and week after week, so then that can wear you out in just the same way as a negative stress. So yeah, it makes it even more complicated that we also have to be a little bit concerned with positive stress that you can only have. It's not something that you can have as much as possible. You still need to find those ways to calm down. And I would always start with sleep. That's sort of the absolute starting point for balancing your days, because many times we can't change everything or too many things about our day, but we can prioritize sleep and make sure that we do everything we can to allow enough time for sleep.
So let's focus on the subject of sleep a little bit more. So it's important to sleep enough, but what are like the other things that you need to take in account in order to have a healthy sleeping routine?
Yeah, well, lots of things, but let's a few basics. So I would say that the first is prioritizing that time for it, to really, if you have to put it in your calendar, do that, but make sure that if you feel like you need 8 hours or 9 hours or 7 hours, try to make sure that you allocate the time for that. That's clearly the first thing. I think the second most concrete thing is to pay attention to what you do in the 1 to 2 hours before bedtime. It's it's often not possible to change the stress that you have during the daytime, but then the time period right before bedtime, that's where we, most of the time, we can make some good choices or not so good choices. So that's when our rhythm should be slowing down instead of sort of picking up and trying to do everything that you didn't get done. People sometimes have a tendency to, okay, I'll just quickly clean the house, or women and especially, or I'll do a couple more loads of wash, or I'll check my emails, or do those kind of to-do lists that are endless. And if you do that right before bedtime, even if they're not bad activities per se, but they leave you really activated and engaged, and then it can take a long time to come down from that. Another really sort of acute or current example is this war that's going on. It's horrible, and it's, everyone feels like you need to know what's going on. But if you watch nonstop news in the evening for a few hours before bedtime, it's really, really hard to empty your brain out of that. And it can be very difficult to go to sleep. So as much as we need to understand what's happening in the world, probably having some kind of a cut point that, okay, no more news, and then try to do something that leaves you with more of a peaceful mind as much as possible anyway.
So should you also have like some kind of a clear routine before you go to sleep? Like there are, you mentioned all those different things that you need to take in account, like not have too much stuff that might affect like your mental stimulation. But should you like always do the same things before going to sleep? Because I found it to be a little bit tedious to like always have like an exact same routine before I go to sleep. So do we need to have like a structured plan before we fall asleep?
No, I don't think it's necessary. We are individuals, and if you are a very sensitive person who loves organization in their lives, I think for them it might be really important to have the exact same things that they do. But I would say that most people, if you follow good principles, it's by no means necessary to always do the same thing. If you sleep well in general and don't in general have problems, just paying attention to kind of slowing down and not sort of turning up the gears as you're getting close to go to bed, but instead of switching down towards bedtime. But some people like watching TV. TV in general doesn't disturb our sleep all that much, much less than, for example, some kind of really stimulating computer games, or social media can be quite activating, and it can get us upset or excited or all different kinds of emotions. But social media right before bed in general is not a great thing. But I think you can safely have a range of activities that you find that work for you.
That's an interesting point, that like TV, watching TV is all right during the evening. I've heard, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that like you should limit a blue light before going to bed. Is this something that's accurate at all?
Yeah. There is quite a few studies that show that blue light that's particularly comes from cell phones and tablets and different kind of devices like that, that it does tend to engage our brain or activate our brain even more than sort of the regular lights that we have in the house. And blue light, the closer it is to you, so when you have a phone or a tablet in your hand, it's sort of right there. And some people find help with those kind of blue light blocking glasses even. Not everyone is as sensitive to that. And I think most people now have some kind of a night mode in their phone that helps. I don't know that there is, scientifically, I don't know that I can say that TV doesn't disturb sleep, but we have so much data from people that we have clearly seen that for some people, it can be a good way to sort of park your brain somewhere and just go sit on the couch and watch something enjoyable for an hour, a drama or a comedy or something like that. It can help busy, overperforming people sort of relax and let go of the things that they have to do. And that can actually be helpful. Of course, if they watch a violent horror movie or something like that, that might have quite a different effect. And we do have data from that too. But as long as it's something reasonable that you're watching, if you find that that helps you relax, I wouldn't put that on a blacklist by any means.
Okay, that's interesting. And yeah, I definitely understand that if you watch some kind of an action movie or a horror movie, then it might be a different story there.
Maybe one more thing about the sleep. that's really acute right now with springtime here in Finland, and days are getting longer and longer, and daylight is coming in really late at night, and only getting worse over the or better the next couple of months. So the dark light cycle actually has quite a bit to do with our ability to sleep well. And if you are a really good sleeper, it might not disturb you all that much, but anybody who is a sensitive sleeper or has trouble with sleeping, it really is worthwhile to pay attention to make sure that your bedroom is really, really dark. And also trying to make sure that in those 2 hours before bedtime, when I mentioned to kind of switch off, also try to make sure that you don't have bright daylight pouring into the house at that time. Because if the sunshine is bright in your face, it gives the brain a signal that it doesn't give the brain a signal it's time to go to bed. Melatonin, which is a natural hormone, it kind of starts secreting when it gets dark. But if it's super bright in the evening, it sort of blocks that natural sleep hormone from starting to get active. So that is something that we who live here in the north, we get used to sleeping in bedrooms that are light. But physiologically, it makes perfect sense to have a dark bedroom, because it gives the right signs to your brain that now it's time to sleep. And so if you haven't yet tried darkness or those kind of light blocking curtains, or at least a mask or something like, it's worth trying that. And then in the wintertime, the challenge is just the opposite, of course, that then we don't get daylight hardly ever. And then we need to try to artificially make sure we open the curtains in the morning and try to get all the daylight we can during the daytime.
Yeah, that is true. I sleep myself with a mask, and I've noticed that it really does help. I know you talk about constructing a balanced daily life a lot in many of your channels. Do you have any tips on that, how to make your daily life as such that you don't have too much stress and you still have enough recovery?
Yeah, I think there's some very sort of basic principles that almost everyone can apply to their own life. Not in the same exact way, because we have different kind of job situations and different kind of realities in our lives. But one very good principle is that try to make sure that you take some kind of breaks from the work that you do, especially if it's sort of information work. You are sitting in front of a computer all day, maybe remotely, so you're not really going anywhere. So it's really important physically and mentally to get up from your desk and do some kind of break exercise, or take a short walk, or maybe lie down and relax for a little bit. If you're working remotely, it can even be a few house tasks or something like that, but you just need those short breaks once in a while. The ability to perform cognitively is much better when you sometimes take that break. And it can be tough in many work groups, the ongoing Teams meeting culture or Zoom meeting culture. It's really, that's one of the biggest stressors that people have listed in the last few years, that their days are, it just goes from one meeting to the next. And one of the things that we discuss with work groups is that how to really apply this idea of 50-minute meetings or 25-minute meetings instead of going 30 minutes and an hour. And then always when one meeting ends, you have to step right into the next one. And if you have that 5-minute break, you can use it in any way possible that works for you, but it's some kind of a mental break before the next one. And I think another daily structure thing, well, eating, of course, our body needs fuel. So we need to try to give it some good fuel regularly. So if you skip your breakfast and skip your lunch, it's much harder to stay energetic and the stress level starts climbing. So no matter where you are, it's good to have some kind of food available so that you are every few hours you are taking some kind of calories, good calories, fruit or snacks or a good lunch. That helps us stay engaged. And then some kind of physical activity. It doesn't mean exercise, doesn't mean that you have to find an hour to go running or go to the gym or something like that. But if you just sit at your computer and do work and you don't have any kind of activity in the day, it's really easy to get tired and the stress level starts to climb. But some kind of physical activity, lunchtime walk, or some people take walking meetings, little few minutes of exercise at home, something like that. It's good to build that into your workday in some way or another. And that's where some kind of a device can be actually really helpful. If you have a activity monitor or something like that, and you notice that, okay, there's 200 steps and it's already 4 p.m., then you know you haven't moved enough. And it can be a good reminder to get going and do something active.
There are quite a lot of topics that I would like to get more into. I think the first one that I was interested was about the diet. So like, what kind of a diet should you have in order to stay in a recovered state? Like, you should eat quite often, if I'm correct, but like, what kind of food should you consume?
Yeah, I think probably within the limits of today's podcast, it's best not to go too deep into different kind of diets. And I think there is not one diet that is the optimal one. The key principle is probably, like you said, to eat regularly to make sure you don't get too hungry and your blood sugar level really starts to drop. But of course, if you compare a really, really big, heavy lunch to maybe something that's a little bit more vegetables and a little bit lighter, you're probably going to be more energetic in the afternoon if the lunch is not huge. Because if you have a really big lunch, then it's really easy to, you feel like, okay, it would be nice to take an hour nap after that, and that might not be possible. So probably a little bit lighter foods in the middle of the day is going to keep your energy level better. But of course, it has to have enough calories to keep you going like that.
You mentioned earlier the incorporating short breaks into the day in relation to when you have done coaching for work communities. Do you have any other thoughts on how to improve the wellness in work communities, especially?
Yeah, I think the certain kind of expectations and rules that the work community can create can really be helpful. With the 50-minute meetings is one example of that it doesn't happen unless the work as a group sort of decides that is possible. It has to start usually from the management and it's possible. And then you have to also follow it up that, okay, we are at 50 minutes. Let's schedule another meeting if it's completely not done, instead of run overtime on that. Emails can be another thing, especially in international work communities where people can be in different time zones. So it's some team members might be sending their emails in the evening because that's their daytime. But if your expectation is that you have to answer to emails, so then you have people getting back to emails at 8 or 9 p.m. And unless it's made clear that you're not expected to answer work emails in the evenings, it has to be sort of the permission not to answer has to be established. Otherwise, many employees might feel like to be a good, effective employee, they are expected to get back as soon as possible, especially if they notice that, okay, so-and-so has already answered that email, so I better put my 5 cents worth in there too, and that's not a good way. So I think that those kind of decisions and rules have to be established, that what's expected and what's not expected. I mentioned walking meetings earlier. I think that in some situations can be quite a good way to get a little bit of fresh air and a little bit of physical activity. If it's something to discuss between a couple of colleagues, for example, where you don't have to be at a computer. Many people have found that to be a good way to do certain kind of meetings. But of course, it doesn't work for all meetings.
Do you find that workplaces easily adopt these or take these decisions at all?
Well, at least they're being discussed. I've given quite a few wellness lectures to very different kinds of companies in the last few years. And clearly the topics are on the table, but there is some frustration that it's, unless everyone commits to that, it's hard for that to actually happen. But I think it's being discussed a lot more than before. So that's a positive. And I think little by little, these kind of things, they are understood better. And it's sort of the employer level is starting to also understand that you can't just milk your employees for everything until they finally can't do it. That it has to be a sustainable situation where they can also take care of their well-being.
We talked about the data collection a little bit earlier and how like individuals can sort of track or monitor their recovery. I would like to talk about, we mentioned the Garmin devices, how they collect heart rate data and so on. But what kind of data does like FirstBeat collect? How does FirstBeat aid in supporting recovery?
I'm actually wearing my FirstBeat device right now. You can't see it, but it's on my chest, and it's attached to my body with electrodes, and it actually detects every beat of my heart. And we use that kind of it's sort of like a professional wearable, because we feel like the accuracy of that is really, really high. We can really accurately detect every beat of the heart and then analyze heart rate variability, which is a phenomenon that allows us to to look at the balance between stress and recovery. We can see the sympathetic nervous system, which is the stress system, and then parasympathetic, which is the recovery system. And our method is sort of based on constantly trying to determine that balance. It's okay to have stress, but do you have enough recovery? And what kinds of activities help you recover? And we rely on this kind of, this is not a device that you wear every day, all the time. You might wear it for 3 days at a time and then maybe measure it again next month or in a few weeks. It's called First Beat Life. And it's, the idea is that you do these kind of more detailed checks every once in a while. And we believe in that because we feel like the data is accurate at movement, during rest, anything that you do all day, 24/7. But these wearables, they use a slightly different principle. They detect your pulse from your wrist or from your finger. They can still get similar phenomena. Like your Garmin, I have a Garmin also. It does give you ideas about stress and recovery. And the idea is that people could learn from their what they do. And then when they can look at data and they can see some kind of correlation that, okay, I took a nap and it's nice to see that I've got some good recovery on my watch. So I think having a wearable can be a nice support for something more detailed. But right now, our method is something that we feel like you can more confidently draw conclusions from stress and recovery balance, for example, with this type of a device.
Yeah, I also have the Garmin device and it collects heart rate data pretty accurately. But well, let's go back to the party example. If I'm at a party, my heart rate might be very, very high, and it's not completely due to like physical activity. So it's more up to the user to be able to interpret the data from the device. And I think the First Beat application provides a little bit more, well, it's a different kind of like usage, but provides a little bit more accurate data on that, on how to, on how you're actually recovering and what kind of activity you are participating in.
Yeah, I think the visual part that we provide, you get sort of a 24-hour graph that shows you can keep a journal, so you can see your journal, you can see what you were doing and then see what the physiology looked like during that. And that helps you really learn from those kind of actions, what you did. So I think that kind of detail is sort of unique to our method. But what you mentioned about the context, like at the party, for example, that's true with our measurement too, that you always have to understand the context, that just because my First Beat Life shows that I have a big stress peak in my data, or if my Garmin shows the same thing, it doesn't mean that I had some kind of a huge negative stress response. It could be that it was something very positive. Maybe I was excited because Finland won some hockey game, or maybe I'm positively excited about some other thing. So the context is always important to understand.
Definitely, yeah. I think we could move towards the end of this episode at this point. So we have talked a lot about what is the current state of recovery tracking and monitoring, and what are ways to help people to recover. I would like to talk about or turn our head towards the future a little bit. So what are like the recent findings about recovery, or what are some insights that maybe you have found in your studies or during your current job at First Beat? What do we know about, what have we known about recovery lately?
Yeah, well, we have a large database. We've done hundreds of thousands of these kind of 24-hour measurements for the last over 10 years now. So we've collected this database that really we can draw some kind of sort of population level trends from that. And we have been digging into that every few years and coming up with some interesting statistics. For example, a few years ago was this, that Saturday, actually, according to our database, Saturday is the most stressful day of the week. It's not only negative things. It's probably maybe a little bit more alcohol than other days and maybe a late evening and doing too many things. But when we compare different weekdays, that came out as the most stressful day. But I think the most interesting recent findings was some differences that came out during the pandemic. So during the 2 years when when the pandemic started and we were put to remote work and kind of everything changed a lot. So that also showed when we compared our database from the previous years compared to this 2-year period. The most dramatic change was that the amount of activity dropped really dramatically. So when we looked at the days, number of work days where there is less than 1,000 steps, which means basically if you have less than 1,000 steps in a day, that means that you're probably just moving between different rooms of your house. And that more than tripled in all fitness categories. So whether you were really fit athlete or just a regular person or a very unfit passive person, for each of the categories, the number of those really, really passive days tripled or even more than tripled. So that was kind of a warning sign that we really have to, if you are remote working, you have to find a way to get some kind of activity, that it's definitely not a healthy situation to be moving that little. If you go to the office, usually, even if you're not doing sports or exercise, you get some thousands of steps just from walking to the bus or walking to the train or going to lunch from your office and those kind of things. So that was the most dramatic recent finding. In addition to that, we did find that people were sleeping a little bit longer and they were getting a little bit more recovery compared to the previous years. And I think the explanation for that is actually very logical because we didn't commute, we didn't go anywhere. So we had time to sleep a little bit more. And because we stayed in the house, in a way, there was less that typical kind of buzz and activity and running around that usually causes some kind of stress, even if it were to be positive stress. But if you're only at the house, you're moving so little, so you tend to have a little bit more recovery. And in a way, it's a positive finding, but it's not a sustainable situation. We can't say that we should continue living like that. So I think really the lesson from that is that how to try to hold on to those good principles even as life gets busy again and try to make sure that you still prioritize enough sleep and that you still find those ways to sometimes calm down and switch off for a little while. And even if you have a very busy day going on.
That's a very good tip. It's sometimes hard because I have this kind of attitude that if I want to train, I need to sort of actually have a good workout, and it can be hard to maintain the fitness levels by just going for a little walk. It doesn't, if I want to participate in some kind of a sporting activity, I want to really get into it. So yeah, I understand why people are having problems with it or have been having problems with it during the pandemic. But yeah, maybe the take home message for people is just that they should be more kind towards themselves and shouldn't be too demanding of how good quality should physical activity be, if we're talking about that.
Yeah, and that's a really good general take home message. Be a little bit more kind to ourselves, that we do tend to demand a lot of ourselves. And I think if we take, we don't have to expect perfection. We don't have to follow a certain perfect prescription of life every day. But if we follow those good principles most of the time, I think we are a long way towards feeling better. And with exercise, maybe we just a sort of a concluding statement on that, of course, if you want to improve your fitness, you do sometimes have to train really hard and get your heart rate up. There's no question about that. But even if you do that kind of a hard training once per day, it's still good to have some of that sort of daily activity, walking around a little bit and doing something light. And for people who aren't athletes, who aren't really training in some kind of a goal-oriented way, for them to accept that sometimes if you have a stressful day, busy day, lots going on, 30 minutes of walking can actually be much, much better for your health than going for a 30 minutes all-out run with lactic acid burning in your muscles. So sometimes that kind of easy workout is going to be much, much better mentally, but also for your fitness. If there is too much going on in your life, then the hard training is not going to make it any better.
And isn't it so if you're very stressed out and have too much on your plate that it's better to take this light workouts than doing something really hard?
Yeah, absolutely. That if you have a really stressed situation and then you top that off with a really hard workout, that's like a recipe for a bad sleep, most likely, because then they in a way they compile on each other and it can be very difficult to calm down after that. So yeah, after a very stressful day, just maybe figure that today I'll just do something easy and maybe I'll do my harder workout tomorrow. So that kind of flexibility is a good principle to keep in mind if you're training hard.
Yeah, I think this has been a very insightful conversation, but I would just like to ask in the end, there has been a lot of tips that have come up during this episode, but what are like three concrete tips for improving recovery? If you could name some kind of ideas, what could people start doing to aid them in their recovery process?
Well, number one, make sure that you plan enough time for sleep. So just dedicate that time for sleep and stick with that. Number two, look after your fitness. We do find that people who have good fitness, they have better capacity to recover. So fitness does. It might acutely stress you out, but in the big picture, if you have good fitness, your body's capacity to recover is better. So definitely, especially for those who aren't fit right now, even just small improvements on your fitness is going to improve your recovery ability. And then I think third, let's take that, even if you have a lot of stress in your life, start building that kind of evening routine that works for you and pay attention to what you do in the 1 to 2 hours before bedtime and find things that help you switch off and slow down, because that can go a long ways. Sort of it can cancel out a stressful day and help you go to sleep even after that.
Very good tips. And I think everyone, including us here, the host, should take those advice seriously in order to help our recovery. Hey, thank you very much, Tiina, for coming to this episode. If there is something that's coming up on First Beat or any kind of blogs or anything that you want to advertise, you have a free spot here.
Yeah, thanks. It was really, really nice to have a chat with you. Yeah, follow FirstBeat, firstbeat.com on our website. You can find lots of interesting articles in there. I have a blog that I write fairly regularly, so you can find it there as well. And if you have questions about FirstBeat Life or something like that, so just go to our website and there is contact forms and information that you can find there. I'll probably be posting something on LinkedIn about this chat as well. And I'll even share my data during the chat and let's see how stressful it was for me. So
great.
That sounds very good. To end this episode, what's coming up on Jyväskylä Entrepreneurship Society next?
The next events that coming is an after work, the 20th of April with the founders of Happy Second. And follow Jesse's social media channels if you want to stay up to date about what's happening next. Our Instagram is Jyväskylä_ES and Facebook is Jyväskylä Entrepreneurship Society. Thank you so much for listening to this episode and tune in next episode too. Thank you. Yes, cast.